Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to begin to look into some of the complicated diplomatic manoeuvrings between Britain and America during the Second World War, particularly over the question of the Middle East, the most strategically important theatre of the war in many ways, it being the source of vast quantities of oil from Saudi Arabia. The British had been the hegemonic power in the Middle East since 1919, having been able to limit French ambitions, and after the fall of France in 1940, the strength that the French were able to project in the Middle East, either the Vichy French or the Free French forces, was greatly limited, much to the outrage of Charles de Gaulle. Following the entry of the United States into the war in December 1941, Franklin Roosevelt was very keen to find out about the region and the prospects for the continued survival of the British in the Middle East, facing as they were a resurgent Germany in North Africa and a German subversion in places such as Iraq. Another key area of American concerns about the Allied operation in the Middle East and North Africa was the Franco-British relationship. The Franco-British relationship between the British forces in Mesopotamia, or Iraq as it was later titled, and if the French forces in Syria, the British in Palestine and the French in Lebanon, had deteriorated from 1919 onwards up until 1939, as both sides sought to play Arabs and Jews off against the other, and sought to use the nationalist tensions in each other's spheres of influence in the Middle East to dislodge one another. And de Gaulle, who had effectively been rescued by the British in 1940 and in exile kind of groomed to be the leader of the Free French movement, saw the struggle in the Middle East equally as a struggle against Great Britain as it was against Germany. When he met Franklin Roosevelt's plenipotentiary, Franklin Roosevelt's foreign policy envoy, Wendell Willkie, who had contested the 1940 presidential election against Roosevelt and thought he might be up for a repeat performance in 1944. De Gaulle told Willkie that the struggle at the moment was with the British, and it would be really the question of who would dominate Syria and Lebanon, the French or the British. Well, by the end of the war, it's the British. The British actually have to intervene in Syria and Lebanon in order to return the Free French armies to their barracks and strip them of their arms when they suppress nationalist revolts in Damascus and in Beirut with unprecedented ferocity and violence. So much so that the British army is forced to, under Churchill's orders, to intervene. So today I'm looking at Lords of the Desert by James Barr, which is a kind of sequel to his amazing book, A Line in the Sand. Both are meticulously researched and really show what somebody who understands the kind of archival research very well can achieve. They are superb reads. The Lords of the Desert is more focused on the post-war years and Britain and America's really quite hidden struggle to control the Middle East and its economic spoils after the war. James Barr writes about the Anglo-French relations before 1939. He writes, "Such was the bad blood that when France fell in 1940, the French administration in Beirut sided not with Britain, but with Vichy. When the Vichy administration then let Germany use Syria as a base to make trouble in Iraq in 1941, British and Free French forces invaded Syria and Lebanon and took over. In an effort to win local support, shortly before the invasion, the Free French had promised that they would make Syria and Lebanon free and independent. Once installed in Beirut, however, de Gaulle backpedaled. Although he was happy to behave like La France personified when he felt like it, the moment that Wilkie, Roosevelt's advisor, asked him when France would give up her mandate, he became most evasive. 'I hold it in trust,' he answered. 'I cannot close out that mandate or let anyone else do so. That can be done only when there is a government again in France.' So the occupation of France became a convenient excuse for the indefinite control of French mandates. By that point, relations between the French and the British were close to rupture over the issue of Lebanese and Syrian independence. The British had effectively guaranteed the Free French promise and were under pressure from Lebanese and Syrian nationalists to hold de Gaulle to account. One significant British problem during the war was the question of the Palestine mandate. The mandate had been established in 1919 at the Paris Peace Conference. However, Britain had occupied Jerusalem and the rest of the Ottoman provinces, the Ottoman territory that would make up Palestine since 1917, and it was then that the Balfour Declaration was brought into effect, which guaranteed a national homeland for Jewish people in Palestine. Of course, the British interests were geopolitical and strategic. They wanted a state that they could control that would act as a buffer to the Suez Canal, that would prevent enemy forces from establishing themselves right on the edge, the eastern edges of the canal, as had happened during the First World War with the Ottoman Empire. And the likes of Balfour took a number of high-handed and largely misguided assumptions that not only would Jewish people around the world be hopelessly grateful to the British Empire for establishing them a homeland in Palestine, but also the wealth that it was imagined they would bring with them. There was kind of some quite anti-Semitic tropes mingled in with supposedly well-meaning British policy, that the money that they would bring with them would revitalise the Palestinian economy, and this would somehow trickle down to the Arab peoples there, who would be have their living standards raised by Jewish entrepreneurship. Of course, all of these are wild assumptions. A deeper kind of level of anti-Semitism in British thinking was that if the British didn't offer a Jewish homeland at the outcome of the war, then the Kaiser might, and nefarious Jewish bankers and Rothschilds and all these sorts of, you know, again, anti-Semitic tropes, anti-Semitic ideas, would shift wealth and finance away from the British Empire and towards Germany. One only needs to look at the living conditions of people like Chaim Weizmann and the other leading Zionist politicians and activists at the time to realise that if they did have vast sources of undisclosed wealth, they were very well hidden. Most of the leading Zionist politicians lived in relative penury for much of their lives. Jewish immigration into the Palestine Mandate throughout the 20s and 30s resulted in an Arab uprising in 1936, and it was the first time in 1936 that the British had considered partitioning Palestine. In addition to that, the British decided that it was time to dramatically decrease the numbers of Jews able to make it into the Mandate, just at the time when mass immigration from Europe was a matter of life and death to countless Jews. So the number was limited to 15,000 a year. And during the war, the British convinced themselves that this would also keep out German agents posing as German Jews. Not that there was any indication that this was something that the Germans might try. Slowly, as the evidence of Nazi atrocities in Europe against the Jews mounted up, the pressure, particularly in America, for a change in British policy began to escalate, and the question of Jewish immigration into Palestine and the question of the establishment of a Jewish state after the end of the Second World War gradually make their way up the political agenda in America. America that hasn't been occupied, America that hasn't been militarily attacked other than Pearl Harbor, is in far is a far better forum for these kinds of debates to actually be heard by the executive. And Roosevelt is listening. Roosevelt is aware that key demographics, Jewish demographics, in cities and in electoral districts across America can hold his fate quite easily if such issues aren't addressed. And so Roosevelt, in turn, was happy to turn to the British to ask for an answer on the outcome of Palestine. Among both Jews and Arabs, there were some moves to create an Arab-Jewish state. James Barr again writes about Henrietta Zold. Originally from Baltimore, now in her 80s, Henrietta Zold had emigrated to Palestine at the turn of the 20th century. Earlier that summer, with several others, she had set up a moderate political party that encouraged both fellow Jews to form personal friendships with Arabs as a first step to the establishment of a binational Jewish-Arab state. Convinced by Zold that goodwill and simple honesty might yet resolve the Arab-Jewish question, Wendell Willkie, who had gone to Palestine to visit her, also used the opportunity to ask her what was getting in the way. I asked her if she thought it was true that certain foreign powers were deliberately stirring up trouble between the Jew and the Arab to sustain their own control. With a sad heart, I must tell you, it is true, said Saul.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
One must realise, however, that Wilkie, something of an Anglophobe, had little love for the British Empire, and how reliable that testimony is questionable. When Wilkie returned home to America in October 1942, he told Roosevelt he had a very negative report to make about the British in the Middle East, that their misrule and mishandling and their constant sort of duplicity with both Arabs and Jews was kindling discontent across the region, particularly among Arabs, that would play directly into the hands of the Axis powers, and that America would be tarnished with the same negativity unless Roosevelt was careful. And that Roosevelt, therefore, had to offer the people of the Middle East some kind of bigger and more libertarian or liberal picture of what could be achieved at the outcome of the war, i.e. Roosevelt had to commit to the dismantling of the British Empire in the Middle East. Of course, Roosevelt can't do this, and there was no question that Roosevelt would be able to request this of Churchill. So Wilkie decided he was going to speak directly to the American population. He broadcast a half-hour programme called Report to the People 2 weeks later in early November. And in it, he described his travels across the Middle East and referred to the peoples of the Middle East as looking to the United States with a degree of respect and hope and goodwill. And the message that America needed to be pressing throughout the Middle East was one of America being a force for liberty. He said, "Beside giving our allies in Asia and Eastern Europe something to fight with, we have got to give them the assurance of what we are fighting for," he said in his broadcast, which was this rather kind of open notion of freedom. "In Africa, in the Middle East, and throughout the Arab world, as well as in China and the Far East, freedom means orderly but scheduled abolition of the colonial system," he declared. "The rule of people by other peoples is not freedom, and not what we must fight to preserve." Now, this is a popular feeling throughout much of American society and throughout many of the American armed forces. It was based less, perhaps, in kind of revolutionary third world nationalism, more in a sense that America's own journey from having been a colony of the British Empire to being an independent republic was kind of opposed, really, to this other historical kind of trajectory of the establishment or the kind of the continuance of the British Empire. The Southeast Asia Command was often jokingly referred to by American soldiers as saving England's Asian colonies, for example. Wilkie defended himself by saying that he wasn't attacking the British, but this is a kind of a classic political play, really. One can say whatever one likes and then backtrack and say, well, I didn't say that or I didn't mean it, really. However, he did say that people around the world knew that America was not fighting for profit or loot or territory or mandatory power over the lives of government or people. That America's motives were pure. Obviously, this is far from being the case. Wilkie was pretty aware that if he wanted to challenge Roosevelt again in 1944, he would need the Jewish vote. He had lost by 20 million votes, or 22 million votes, in 1940. But in Illinois, Michigan, New Jersey, New York and Ohio, where Wilkie had been close to catching up with Roosevelt in all those states, there were significant numbers of Jewish voters who would all be very useful if he could deliver to them a firm promise of a Jewish homeland, or Jewish state even, and mass Jewish immigration at the end of the war. So on the 25th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, which was on the eve of the midterm elections, Wendell Wilkie once again spoke to the American population, but this really focused his message on Jewish voters. He spoke at length about the genocide of Jews in Europe, about the refusal of the British to allow more Jews into Palestine, and he spoke about the sinking of a ship called the Struma. And James Barr writes, earlier that year, the American weekly Life had reported on the methodical massacre of Polish Jews, backed up by the allegation with a series of grim photographs. Then came the news of the sinking of the ship called the Struma. The vessel, an unseaworthy hulk that was crammed with Jewish refugees fleeing Romania and a similar fate, had spent 8 weeks anchored off Istanbul after the British government refused its entry to Palestine. Towed out of the port, the Struma had either hit a mine or was struck by a torpedo in the Black Sea. All but one of its 769 passengers died. Extremists within the Zionist movement and in the United States exploited the anger generated by the Struma disaster. Known as the Revisionists, they had been campaigning for over 20 years for the establishment of an independent Jewish state that stretched east from Jordan. The Struma disaster gave the Revisionists ample ammunition to attack the British with, and in propaganda terms, they had demanded a Jewish army that would not simply a Jewish division within the British army, but a Jewish army that would participate in the war effort. But the British were fairly convinced that the result of arming the Jews would be a war with the Jews in Palestine fairly shortly afterwards, or during the war, as they would simply create a revisionist army able to occupy Palestine when it saw fit. And the revisionists have been a fairly kind of minority voice, and it was the sinking of the Struma that started to give them significant support and, of course, funding across America from that moment onwards. In May 1942, just before Wilkie had gone off on his journeys, there was a conference of Zionists that took place in New York, which showed that opinion had begun to swing in favour of the Revisionist Party. 5 days of discussion at the Biltmore Hotel showed that the delegates were willing to come forth with a public statement, which was later known as the Biltmore Declaration. The Biltmore Declaration condemned the British government's immigration restrictions. It called them cruel and indefensible, and it demanded the transfer of responsibility for immigration policy to the Jews of Palestine. And this would be the prelude to the creation of a Jewish Commonwealth, which would integrate into the structure of the new democratic world, by which it meant the new structures of the United Nations, which were being planned and proposed for after the war. An independent Jewish state, in any other words. And it called for the establishment of a Jewish army, which would eventually manifest itself not in an actual uniformed army, but in the Haganah, the Jewish Defence Force guerrilla army that emerges. But that's a story for another time. Roosevelt, up until this point, had tried not to raise the issue of Palestine with Churchill, but this is becoming more and more difficult. The Zionists had begun to put large front page adverts in American newspapers demanding that Roosevelt take action, so it was becoming more and more embarrassing to Roosevelt. And not only the American Republican Party, but also Roosevelt's own wife, Eleanor, had begun to embrace the cause of a Jewish army serving in the Middle East. See, unlike Roosevelt, Wilkie was not really bound by diplomatic considerations. Wilkie can say and do what he wanted. And Wilkie used this as a position to promote himself, particularly on the eve of the Balfour Declaration anniversary. Wilkie demanded that the British throw open the doors of Palestine, and this was the only way in which Hitler's programme of extermination of the Jewish people, as he put it, could be prevented, and that therefore the British had almost the answer to the Holocaust in their hands, and that the doors of Palestine would also have to be opened anyway for the Jews who survived the war, who would be homeless, who would be unable to return to any of their homelands in Central and Eastern Europe. And the Jews, Wilkie argued, as had the Convention of American Zionists, the Jews should be the people who control immigration into Palestine. Now, the British were obviously irritated by the pronouncements of Wilkie, but Churchill looked at Wilkie in a particular way. Churchill knew that Roosevelt wasn't well, and he didn't believe that Roosevelt would be able to campaign for a fourth term. He was wrong in that. And he thought that Wilkie would win in 1944. This is one of Churchill's typical kind of assumptions that become kind of matter of fact in his mind. And so he didn't wish to completely negate or dismiss Wendell Wilkie either. Now, we'll look in the next couple of podcasts at how the story unfolds and return to Lords of the Desert. But I would recommend making a purchase of it because it's an incredible book, really, really well worth it if you are interested in many of the more hidden histories of imperialism and the Middle East. Anyway, thanks very much for listening. And if you can support us via Patreon, do check out the Explaining History Patreon page, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.